Good evening, James McKenney here with my Science Hour. This is for October 13th, 2022, the ongoing year-long series of the history of discovery of my work, etc. And I want to start this show out with a little bit of an anecdote that came to mind this past week, and so I'll do this sometimes, jump back into time. And so this would put us back in the, let's say, the early 1990s, and I talked about having an archery business and selling these bows. And so one of these were Old English legacy long bows with all of the paraphernalia, the quivers, the gray goose feathers on the arrows, the bodkin armor piercing tips. And so these were the real stuff. These were real archery. In the big one that I sold, I called the war bow. Then I had the smaller one, which was called the Maid Marian. That was a lighter bow for kids and women. And then there was a buffalo hunter bow, which was a small flat bow. And then I had some other things like an atlatl, which is a hand-throwing, spear-throwing device, which gives you a much higher velocity on a spear. So I had some things like that, some primitive things. And then some chipped, very nice, what would you call it, flint and onyx chipped knives with bone handles, things like that. But at any rate, I wanted to recount this one incident because I was selling these. A lot of people that were involved in Old English replica fairs, like one of the big ones that many of you have possibly gone to, was called the Renaissance Fair. It started in Minneapolis, Minnesota, one of the biggest ones, with tens, hundreds of thousands of people attending these. And everything is like Old England. The people talk like that, your accent, everything about you, your dress and everything. And so anyway, I sold a lot of these bows to people in those roles, et cetera, actors, et cetera, and people that just loved archery. But at any rate, there was an incident which took place, and the woman who made my strings, now she was an elderly woman, and her craft, so to speak, was weaving. And she would make string out of cotton, out of wool, etc. And so also she had flax. And now flax is actually linen is the material. It's the fiber that comes out of the flax plant. And flax happens to be a very good nutrient. It's one of the ingredients of the original bread of the ancient Bible, which was a survival food. Flax was one of the main ingredients, the flax seed. And so at any rate, and by the way, I just thought of that. I did sell flax seed for a while during my career. I was on an airplane. I got on an airplane and I'm sitting there and I'm talking to this lady next to me and we're just chatting back and forth. And I'm talking about, I don't know, we're just chatting back and forth. And so I mentioned some things, and she goes, "Have you ever heard of James McKenney?" And I'm like, and maybe we're talking about, you know, some planets or something like that, who knows. But she goes to me, she says, "Have you ever heard of James McKenney?" And I said, "I am James McKenney." And she looked at me and she could tell my voice. Then she screams out on the airplane, "I'm sitting next to James McKenney." And she screams this out like two times. And her other members of her family were sitting around in the airplane and they were all looking around. And all these other people are like looking. And it's not like I like public exoneration or anything like that. It was rather comical, I think. But anyway, it turned out that this woman was part owner of a flax company up in the Dakotas where they were selling flax. So I became, I said, "Well, I'd like to sell the flax," you know, and so I did. For a while, I sold the flax on my webpage. But anyway, that's one story. But anyway, that just came to mind as I was thinking about flax. But this lady who had worked in some of the groups within the Renaissance Festival was a weaver by her trade. That was her craft. And anyway, she made the linen string raw material for me that I made my bowstrings out of because I wanted authentic old English strings. And so at any rate, she, I don't know if she bought a bow or if I gave her a bow or something like that. And so early in the morning, one morning before their festival started, I went out and I brought some bows down, and I had my own bow. Of course, I had probably 20 or 30 bows of my own. And so anyway, this woman and I took a walk out in this big hayfield. It was fall time of the year. And so we're walking out, and the sun is rising and the dew is lifting off the ground. She was talking about Robin Hood being a very good shot with the archery equipment, etc., that he was able to split an arrow. And I said, well, that's nothing. I can split an arrow in midair, of an arrow flying in midair. And she's like, no, you can't do that. Nobody could possibly do that. And I'm a physicist. I know about flight. I know about wind resistance and the trajectories. And it's a little bit of a trick, because with the long bows, you have a very heavy arrow that does not suffer from wind resistance. In other words, the arrow follows a perfect parabola type of trajectory. And so it does not suffer from wind resistance. And the other principle of physics is that, and we used to do this in the laboratory, and maybe freshman, sophomore year physics in the laboratory where I went to college, is you'd take a steel ball and you'd put it on a little magnet up at the top where you had a button control. And that same button controlled the launch of another steel ball from across the room. And what you would do is you would aim the little cannon, which had a steel ball in it, the same size as the steel ball that you had on a magnet that would drop straight down, and you would aim that ball in the cannon directly at the ball. And what would happen is they would fall at the same rate, even though the ball from the cannon first went up and then fell down. But the idea is that they were falling vertically with the force of gravity at the same acceleration, velocity, etc., and they would collide. And so I knew this little trick. And so all I had to do was aim perfectly at her arrow in mid-flight, and it would be just like shooting. But of course, this is out 75 yards. This is not at a target 20 yards away that's sitting there still. This is a moving target. That's by the time her arrow gets out there, it's probably out there 75 or 80 yards. But anyway, she goes, no, nobody could possibly do that. And so anyway, she pulls back and she lets her arrow go. And I wait a second and I pull back and I let go of my arrow. And my arrow hits her arrow in mid-flight and actually crossing. So my arrow comes in from the side and directly hits her arrow. And the woman screams out. She's just like, I can't believe this. So we go back to where the festival is. And she comes in screaming, he's better than Robin Hood. He can hit an arrow and split an arrow in midair. And so anyway, it's a little bit of a trick and, of course, a somewhat luck, but a lot of skill. And one time I went with some young youth archers, and I was going to do a demonstration. And so we set up a target at about a 45-degree angle and walked back probably about 160 yards. And I took, at that time, I was using a Bear, it's a small, short recurve, a Bear Kodiak recurve bow. I think it was a 55-pound bow. And so fairly stout, young, small recurve bow. And so I pulled it back and let the arrow go, and it hit the target dead center at 160 yards. And these kids who wanted to learn about archery were just shocked and amazed that anybody could possibly do that. But I'd spent my whole life growing up with a bow in my hand because, I think I told this story about when I was little, I had my little wooden bow that I had made. And for my birthday, my dad bought me my first real bow, which was a Bear 40-pound recurve. I think it was a Cub was the model name. But at any rate, just wanted to mention that about hitting the arrow in mid-air. And of course, it came with a lot of practice, with a lot of understanding the physics of the situation, understanding that the longbow had a very heavy arrow and that it was not disturbed by air resistance and things like that. So sometimes I'll jump back in time when I think of these anecdotes and little bit stories that are very interesting, I think, for people to know, you know, because when I was young, there was no TV, there was no internet, I went to the library a lot, and I remember talking about reading Aku Aku and Kon-Tiki one summer, in the summertime, and then of course we had sports, baseball in the summertime, and then riding my bicycle and playing baseball with my friends, etc. And then also archery. And so I spent a lot of time with a bow in my hand and walking out. Whenever I walked out into the country, I'd walk out early in the morning and wouldn't come back until late at night. And nobody ever, my mom never questioned. She just knew that I knew how to take care of myself. So when I was up in, say, the Canadian wilderness for, you know, many months at a time, living outside with no shelter, nobody even thought about it. They just knew I knew how to take care of myself. I'll talk about another incident that happened when I came back from Canada. There was and this is after being up there and finally coming back towards civilization. I got a wind of a family, actually a couple families, that were up in the woods, holed out in a cabin, and they were going to live there throughout the winter. And I believe they had food, so they were okay there, but they didn't have firewood. They said, these people are out of firewood. And so I was about 3 miles away, as the crow flies, about 3 miles. But between where I was and where they were, was a large cliff. And so anyway, I decided that I wanted to go help these people get firewood. And this is in the middle of the winter. This is like February when I finally came back from up in central Canada. And so I spent a day preparing food. I prepared some bread, some rye bread. And I remember preparing other types of food, some dried meat and things like that to bring along with me. And then I had a toboggan and I put a chainsaw and gasoline, 5 gallon container, gasoline and oil and the files and everything I would need to maintain the chainsaw. And the next morning early, I set out, put my clothes on, had my extra clothes in case I had to sleep outside, in case I didn't make it the first day, because I was walking probably in about 4 feet of snow. And so I set out along the trail, climb up through the passageway, and finally made it up to where these people were, where these families were staying by the end of the day. And remember that the winter day up in these northern latitudes is about maybe 6 hours long. In February, it's probably still around 6 hours. 6 hours of daylight, and when darkness comes, it's dark right away. And so you have to get everything done in that amount of time unless you've got light. And of course, I didn't have any light. So I started out very early in the morning at the crack of dawn, actually before, and started walking. And I got to this place by sundown. And so I spent the next 2 days cutting wood. And so cutting wood down to firewood size, getting it ready for these people so they had firewood for the rest of the winter, which would be a number of months. So we're talking quite a bit of firewood. And it's, of course, burning in very inefficient handmade stoves that these people had. They were poor people. And so I finished that, and then the next morning I wake up and I have to come all the way back. And, of course, the snow had snowed, and so my tracks were covered up. And, of course, the other thing you have to do is be careful of wolves, because there are packs of wolves running loose in these areas during the winter. And so I had to pack some heat with me also and carry that, which is an extra amount of weight. And so anyway, I make it back, all the way back down to where I was. And at that point, I packed up and left for civilization. went down and got my nice telecommunications job, etc. And so anyway, I wanted to mention that because that was the kind of condition I was in those days. I could never do that now. There's no way in the world I could pack up and walk that distance with that amount of extreme activity and then work for a couple of days in the woods cutting firewood and then come back and repeat the trek back all on by foot, on, you know, pulling a toboggan full of laden with materials. And so, the you know, along with everything I was pulling, the toboggan probably had, you know, maybe 100 pounds of cargo on it between the gasoline, the chainsaw, and everything else. And the protection equipment, if you want to call it that. At any rate, last week I left off, I was talking about some talk show hosts and some guests I had on my shows, etc. And the things I didn't get in were the Amateur Astro Project. I want to talk about that, but I also want to talk about a few of the talk show hosts that I didn't get a chance to talk about last week. There's a man, Peter J. Peters. He had a station that still is active. It's called Scriptures for America. And not a powder puff Bible preacher. He was a hard-hitting person who understood how the world really worked. And that's why I liked being on his program. And of course, he was not liked by the CIA. He was not popular with them. And I think when I understood of his demise, getting sick, etc., you often wonder. I don't have any proof of that. But the last show that I did as a guest on his radio show was after I published the Calculate Primes book. And what I started doing, once I started realizing the patterns in the prime numbers, is I started analyzing major world events like 9/11. You have September 11th of 2001. And then a number of years later, on March 11th, you had the Fukushima event. And so these are prime numbers in that six-month period between September 11th and March 11th. Six is a very important number in prime numbers. So at any rate, I started putting these patterns together, and I did an entire show with Pastor Peters on the use of prime numbers being used by the secret societies to plan world events that would be major events. And the reason they were using prime numbers is because they believed they had some kind of devil-worshipping characteristics. And of course, I don't believe that at all, but I just was pointing out how these numbers were being used to plan events. And of course, that was one of the reasons when my book Calculate Primes came out, it very much angered these people, the secret societies, the bankers, just call them the bankers, European bankers, the Rothschilds, the Jesuits in the Vatican, whose front agency is the Rothschild World Banking Industry. But what they were really, what they really didn't like is that I put order into the prime numbers, where the previously the prime numbers were believed to be totally disjoint, that there was really no rhyme or reason to them. And I put order into the prime numbers, which they hated, because the reason they used them to plan world events is because they were random, so to speak, and had no order. Okay, so at any rate, the other thing I want to mention about Pastor Peters is that around the same time he produced a CD, a number of CDs called DC Sorcery. And what they did is they took Washington, D.C. and the street layout. The street layout of Washington, D.C. has a lot to do with sorcery, devil worship, the Rothschild banking empire. And you look at London, for example, there are three monoliths, one in Washington, D.C., one in London, and one in Rome, in the Vatican Square. And these monoliths are related. They're related in their belief system of a power structure that's worldwide. So Rome and the Vatican are the primary one with the Jesuit-controlled Rothschild Bank. London is a secondary, and it is related to the bank also. And then Washington, D.C. is related to the military, and which the CIA is the police force of the World Bank, and they basically create chaos, go out and control the world, and set up governments, destroy governments, start wars, cause destruction of governments, political candidates, put them in, bring them in from foreign countries, set them up, elect them, create governments out of there, and then run the news media in the country, run the banking systems in the country, have the international corporations come in, which they also own. As, for example, in the United States right now, there are two major corporations that own all of the major businesses in the United States. But the point is that the CD that Pastor Peters did a lot of work in studying this, and with the drawings, etc., and analyzing the street layout and the architecture, etc., of Washington, D.C., and it also has to do with a lot of architecture in New York City. If you look at some of the buildings there and some of the, what would you call them, just monuments, they are very much structured towards this world government, world banking government to control. And of course, the dates, if you look at the dates when the, say, the World Banks established the Federal Reserve in the United States now, And of course, the DC Sorcery CD that Pastor Peters put out described this and made it public. There are other people that have talked about these similar topics. I'm not going to go and name drop at this point, but there are other people out there who have identified these same issues. And of course, why am I talking about this related to the history of my work is because my work flies in the face of these people. The revelation to the public that Planet X types of objects don't look like big orange balls, that's one of their favorite disinformation ploys, because they know that the public, if they really understood the issues of Planet X types of objects, and that there's not one, but there's thousands of them, we don't know when the next one might come into the solar system, and they would lose power. They would simply lose their stranglehold on the world, the financial, if you look at the mortgages, what does mortgage mean? In the Colburn, in the true Old Testament, it was outlawed. Usury interest, interest based on interest, based on interest, based on interest, compounding interest was outlawed because it was a way of financially killing the person getting the loan. And so back in the old days, it was called benefactor. That was the person that gave a loan. And beneficiary was the person who received the loan. And every 7 years, all loans were forgiven. So you did not have a debt society. And then there was the question, well, what if you were like only a month away from the seven-year forgiveness period? Well, the person who was the benefactor had so much money, he could lend it out, in knowing that it would be a loss, but it would help society. It would help some person build his house. And one interesting thing is in a lot of even third world countries, people will own their house. It might be you wouldn't live in it yourself. You wouldn't even consider it as a house, but it's something that the people own and they own it. And this is in the United States, home ownership is a thing of the past, but there's a thing called a mortgage. And the mortgagee is the person who has the mortgager is the bank or the person giving the loan. But the root word is mort, which is to kill. It's a kill document. It's to kill the person financially, because once you have mortgages throughout the country, then guess what? There's just not enough money for everybody to pay all the interest. So some people have to go broke. Some people have to fail financially for society in general to pay off their loans. And so anyway, the banking system in the world is corrupt. And now I've spent a lot of time on radio shows talking about the corrupt banking system and the CIA, the police force of the World Bank. And of course, the CIA took over NASA. And NASA, if you want to call it, would be one of my arch enemies. In the, you know, they create disinformation. They create space programs that go nowhere. They create, in fact, there's an interesting video of, it's called NASA Going Nowhere. And it just, in a sense, repeats everything I've been saying over years, but it's very well organized. And it shows that over the decades and, you know, centuries, literally, almost, 75 years since the beginning of NASA, they've not done anything. They have not done anything. And the things they have done are questionable. But at any rate, be that as it may, the CIA took over NASA in 1991, and NASA was very controlled before that, make no mistake. But the real issue hit when Harrington discovered Planet X. And of course, my work, if you followed from the beginning, from its inception, and from where it became public, the years I was at Cornell, it flies right in the face of everything they were doing. And it also flies in the face of something they wanted to very much keep the lid on, and that's a guy named Velikovsky. So you'll see that when I talk about being around people, some of them are very controversial. And so the other thing I want to talk about on this show is social media. Social media. First, I have one other talk show host I want to give some credit to here, and his name is Robert David Steele. Robert David Steele was a CIA operative for many years, not a nice person, but he was very high up, and he understood their international games, the things that they did. He was in charge. He was in charge of developing techniques to infiltrate countries, create disinformation programs, take them over, etc. So he knew the CIA in and out. And then one day, he discovered the Lord. He discovered that, he changed completely and became a person dedicated to freedom. And also, he was the world leader against pedophilia, which is one of the sicknesses that is rampant throughout governments today. And so anyway, I don't want to dwell on that, but it's important to bring this up because I was on Robert David Steele's show many times. He would call me up and say, here's a topic. I know you know about this. Let's do an interview. His interviews were typically short. They're about 20 minutes long. And it would be face-to-face. It would be a Zoom meeting, which he would record and then post. And so I was talking about some rather benign topics like food generation using high concentration growth like the grow towers, for example, and converting warehouses into growth centers. And so you could have these in the middle of a city, and on how would you power these, how would you power the lights, and the distribution of the food to the public. So they were rather benign topics, but Robert David Steele was the world leader for the taking down the pedophile networks that operate worldwide today. And I think that's probably where they took him out, literally, and with supposedly, supposedly he had COVID. But and then they took him to a hospital, but knowing him, something else very much happened to him, where they basically took him out. I think he was getting too close to the real sources on some of these major issues that would expose people internationally, and so he was involved in too many things to break down the world corruption that was going on. And of course, he knew the inside. He had been there. So there's a person that knew very much what was going on. But the reason I'm talking about this is because I'm a scientist. I'm a mathematician. I work at rather esoteric topics. But it seems like every time I do something, I get out into the middle of some big international controversy. like solving the mathematical problem on calculating prime numbers. It's apparently a mathematical problem. But what does it do? It affects people who are using prime numbers as to designate dates for worldwide corruption, for changing the events of human history, etc., in a demonic way. And so I don't plan on being in these positions. It just seems like I am every time I come out with something new. Okay, so at any rate, now I want to talk about how social media has affected my career and my ability to get information to the public. And this started with YouTube. This is decades ago now when YouTube got its first big start. I was banned from YouTube. And this was at also in the Hale Bopp and Planet X days of the early 2000s. This is when YouTube really started to take off. And like I said before, the CIA had been promoting groups starting in 2004, literally in the end of 2004, to try and steal my work. They had handlers, who was the main handler for this group was none other than Tom Van Flandern, and who is and I've already talked about this, I'm not going to repeat it. You know, he was the assistant of Robert Harrington at the Naval Observatory, who was the primary incentive, impetus for the entire Planet X search that was funded by NASA at the Naval Observatory. And he becomes the handler of this group that's trying to basically steal my work, turn it into something crazy. And then, of course, they never, ever talk about the real issue, which is the Planet X topic. Even though Van Flandern's own webpage talks about Planet X-type objects coming in and colliding with and destroying a planet between Mars and Jupiter that then became the asteroid belt. And so, at any rate, oddly enough, he ends up on a coast-to-coast radio show with me. I was talking about that Deep Impact show, July 4th, 2005. Tom Van Flandern's on the same radio show with me, talking about these issues. And very clearly, he's still promoting the idea of a Planet X object colliding with this nameless planet that used to be between Mars and Jupiter, creating the asteroid belt. Well, what more of a Planet X type of object could you want to talk about? I mean, it would be like, that is it. That's Planet X in a nutshell at its worst, directly colliding with another planet. Yet he would deny in public that there was any issue with Planet X at all. A total contradiction. But it might have been the only way he had to continue to say what he really wanted to say when he was under a gag order, literally, under direct threat to say anything. We probably will never know because he's passed on. He's not with us anymore. Okay, so at any rate, all of this is very important to understand the world situation in which my work is trying to develop. And so YouTube comes along. They create a YouTube channel for this outfit trying to steal my work. And then whenever anybody comments below the YouTube video, says James McCanney, you're copying James McCanney's work, or this, if you want to know about this, see James McCanney, whatever the comment, or a link to my webpage, whatever, it would be erased immediately. And this was something we learned early on. YouTube had an algorithm in which if the person putting the comment put a comment, they would still see it as being there, but nobody else saw it. Something they call shadow banning, where only a certain number of people get to see that comment, and they think it's there, but nobody else gets to see it. And so I was the first shadow banned person on the planet, long before the other people today. Now you hear about that as a common thing, whether it's political or talk show hosts or whoever. It's become more common. So from the very beginning of social media, my name and work were banned. And then I want to talk about the Wikipedia. Wikipedia started in the early days, and I don't exactly know the year. Could have been in that same time frame, but that's about the time frame it would have really gotten going. It started to make headway and gain popularity. The initial sentiment or purpose of Wikipedia was to allow anybody to put a comment or write an article on its given topic and add to it. It soon, very soon, as soon as it became popular, and this is what happens with anything that becomes popular with any group, etc., it becomes infiltrated. And it becomes infiltrated by the think tanks, the conservative think tanks in Washington, D.C., and around, you know, Langley, Virginia, etc. And the topics become completely controlled. So originally, there was a commentary about me. You could pop up, type my name in to Wikipedia, and it was blatant lies, disgusting overtures against me, calling me, you know, a crackpot, etc., whatever. And eventually, what they realized is that people would read that and then go to my webpage. And then once they were on my webpage, they would buy my books and study my material and become fans. So what they realized is actually they had advertising that was helping me, even though it was very negative. Because I think people thought, well, wow, this guy is so terrible, I'm going to go check him out. And so once they got to my webpage, then they realized that I had a real story to tell. So Wikipedia discovered that they were just sending people to my webpage and giving me free advertising. It's like in Hollywood, there's an expression that the stars use. They will create some kind of controversy just to get their name in some kind of magazine on the cover or something. Somebody, you know, they write up about this movie star controversy, but the stars use that. They don't care if it's bad press or anything. They just want their name there because then people will identify with them and want to see them in more movies. And that's a technique in Hollywood to get attention, create some ruckus and become popularized in the press and get attention. Henry Ford, the founder of Ford Company, Ford Auto Company, said, say anything you want about Ford, just say Ford. And that's the idea. So Wikipedia soon learned that they were doing nothing but promoting my webpage. So then they took it down. And for, I don't know what's there now. I haven't been there in a long time. But for a long time, it was just James McCanney. If you typed it in, there was no such person. No such person as James McCanney. And so, you know, here I am on international radio shows, one of the most popular guests. I'm on international TV shows from Russia to Japan. I'm, you know, a household word. My name is a household word in many venues. If people are familiar with that industry, if you talk about Planet X or comets or electrical nature of the solar system or astronomy, and, of course, about energy, about alternative energy, and, you know, even water filtration, whatever, my name comes up. Yet, according to Wikipedia, I don't exist. And you can have the most minor topic, and it will be in Wikipedia, but not my name. And so maybe there's something there now. I don't keep track of it. It has no interest. But the interesting thing is they took down the page that was bad-mouthing me because it was just good advertisement. So I should probably write them a letter and thank them and say, please put the page back up where you bad-mouthed me. I used to sell a lot of books because of that. This is the bizarre world that, you know, I've had to live in through all these decades, etc. But Wikipedia became the go-to place for students. If they wanted to write up a term paper or something like that, they no longer went to the library. They no longer took down books. They no longer read in a book. They'd go to Wikipedia and copy what was in Wikipedia, assuming that that was the truth. But the problem with Wikipedia is it gained a certain political correctness, and only authorized referees could post in there or review material. And so it became completely dominated by what you would call standard science, especially when it comes to the realm of science, or when it comes to the realm of anything like, say, religion, or, oh, it just became trash. And so Wikipedia is just trash. That's all it is. There's nothing reliable there. There's, in fact, even about YouTube, I tell people don't go to YouTube to get scientific information. If you want to fix your bicycle, or if you want to fix a flat tire on your car, or if you want to, maybe have a home backyard project planting plants, there's hundreds of channels with people that have very good information, and that's what it's useful for. But about science, don't go to YouTube. Certainly do not go to Wikipedia. You will just get garbage. So people spend a lot of time, and these, you can tell that these are people from, say, standard science, the standard science industry, that have a party line to keep. And of course, they're anonymous. You don't know who these people are. And they can trash names. They can, talk about people. They, like in terms of me, none of these people ever talked about me. That none of these people that talked about me know anything about me. They've never talked to me. They don't know who I am. Never been interviewed me, etc. And there are web pages that are supported, which are basically badmouth me and trash me and things like that. So all I'm talking about here is the trolling that goes on the internet, which is constant, to try and denigrate me and my work. And of course, I'm a little bit of a hard target because I work alone. And so that's one thing that's very clear. And so if they're going to attack me, it's usually an ad hominem attack, calling names, trying to slander me, etc., libel, slander, and things that have nothing to do with my science. And usually these people, sometimes I know who they are, but they're people that don't have any degrees. If they have a degree, they've never published any papers. They have no scientific professional experience, and they're hacks. What they are they're hacks, and they get money under the table, and that's how they live, is by being professional hacks. Anyway, that's the state of the internet today. So I just keep doing what I'm doing, and people listen to me and they understand what I'm talking about, because there's a very simple proverb, if you want to call it that, and it's the equivalent of a psalm. And back in the old days, there was a prophet who was giving a talk, and one of the prophecies was, in the end days, people would be sent out to lead you astray. They would have lies. They would create misinformation, and to lead the general public astray. And one of the people out in the gallery of the prophet said, "How will we, as common people, know what's the truth and what's a lie?" And the answer came back from the prophet that you will know the truth because it's written in your heart. You'll just know it. When you hear the truth, you'll go, that makes sense. That's the truth. And when you hear a lie, your heart will just know it. You'll know that that person over there is giving you a big line of baloney. And what in the industry, we call it a BS meter. And so people like throughout my history, like Earl Crockett or other people, other talk show hosts, etc., they developed this BS meter, we call it. So when somebody comes out, or NASA comes out with some party line or some garbage, or talks about being on Mars with a little rover, the BS meter just goes off scale. You just go, no, there's something really not right about this. And a lot of times you don't know exactly what. But if your BS meter is off scale, chances are it's there for a reason. And when you hear somebody talking, and that's why people follow me, because they listen to what I'm saying. I don't have an agenda. I just present my work. And if you don't like it, there's the knob on that computer or radio or whatever, television set. You can turn it off if you don't like it. But most people leave it turned on. And most people that come to my webpage and come for my information, They are there and they become loyal fans because they know the truth when they hear it. They can sense it. Okay, so now I'm going to continue with the politicization of science. The next topic is Nobel Prize. Wow. Here is something that has always been political. It has always been politicized. It has always been, when you get up into the top levels of the Nobel Prize, especially the physics is the one that's considered probably the top one, or chemistry, because Nobel himself was a chemist. He invented gunpowder. That's where he made all his money. And of course, what is gunpowder used for but war, you know, shells and cannons and armament and rockets or whatever. So anyway, a fantastically wealthy person, and set up this account for the Nobel Prize, which would be an advancement. But like the rules are that the advancement should be of an individual scientist working alone in his laboratory, making a great discovery. And those are kind of the ground rules that have always been there. When the, I think it was the 1979 prize, when the Kobe satellite was honored with the Nobel Prize, in the staff, this is a government project. It did not fall under the standard guidelines of the Nobel Prize. A government-funded project, highly political, talking about the Big Bang confirmation, and it really didn't do that. In fact, I talked before about this, about the Nobel Prizes, how this there had to be a second Nobel Prize to put a Band-Aid on the first one. This is relative to isotropic and anisotropic readings that were later discovered in the background, so-called background radiation, that it was not uniform. Because the Big Bang, the original theoretical work, said that this should be uniform, highly, highly uniform, and it was not. And so they had to have a second Nobel Prize that put a Band-Aid on the first one. But the Nobel Prize has become completely political. The last two Nobel Prizes in physics were given for statistical, it's really, I'm not even going to go into it, but dealing with climate change, which is nothing more than a giant worldwide political football to control water. That's all it is. That's what it's for, and to control the public, to put a tax on the public, to bring down the world public. So all of a sudden you have Nobel Prizes being given for really something that it's in the form of statistics. And what I'll just tell you what it amounts to. These last two prizes amount to statistical conglomeration of energy or accumulation of energy, and all of a sudden being released at a given time. And these are, you know, in any statistical, say you have waves out on the ocean and they're all different heights. Statistically, if you measured the heights of waves, you would get a certain variability in the heights of the waves, and within certain limits, etc. But there are things called rogue waves. Now, how does a rogue wave occur? A rogue wave, say you have 5-foot ocean waves. All of a sudden, there's a wave that's 30 feet high, and it occurs. And sometimes people in sailboats are attacked by these waves. And then that wave goes away almost instantaneously. But if you're unlucky enough to be hit by a rogue wave, then it's a statistical, very highly unlikely statistical configuration of waves, but it's there. And so what they're doing is essentially doing the same thing with energy accumulation and energy distribution relative to climate change. And it really does not apply because climate change is a long-term event. And so it's an incorrect application of statistics and relative to a long-term event like climate change. But they did this, and they give a Nobel Prize for this. And it's really not, even if that effect were true, it would not be Nobel Prize material. But because these researchers chose to include it with climate change, they get a Nobel Prize. That's how political it has become. So trying to work in a world where science is demonized or science is applauded based on political objectives, that's the world we live in now. The other thing that's going on is that the dumbing down of journalists. Now what you see in the journalistic world in science is you see people who have a degree in science studies or something like that. Now, what does that actually mean? Well, they didn't really study science. They have science studies. So they learn about, it's just softened up. It's powder puff college courses. And then they go on to get a degree in journalism. So what is their ability to actually write about science and be a journalist in science? Well, they don't have any. They cannot ask any intelligent questions. They don't understand mathematical constructs. They don't understand contradictions. They don't understand how the science world is politicized. They don't understand anything, yet they are journalists. And you'll see these bubble-headed people on an article, and you see them with their, their bachelor in studies degree, put any word you want in there, but for studies, and like a powder puff degree, and they're writing about science. So what do? They simply take the story from NASA, print it as they are told, and that's journalism now in science. So how can you live in a world where journalism, the journalists don't know anything? All they can do is repeat what they are told. So what I'm doing is setting out the structure for science today. Now, YouTube, Facebook, Wikipedia, other sources of information that are social media are all coming under the same umbrella, where things that do not comply with the standard norms are now being shadow banned or censored completely. And so in a world where they want you to believe certain things. Now, this goes back even to the Middle Ages, where the Catholic Church talked about the flat earth. The reason they did that was to mentally sequester the youth, especially the youth, because the older people were not going to go out. It's always the impetuous youth that want to go out and do things. And if you did not know that the earth was round and that you could sail across and around the world and go around the world in a sailboat, if you thought you were going to sail off the edge of the world and fall off the edge and there were fire-breathing dragons and everything terrible, you wouldn't go there. And that's what they did. They kept the youth there. And that's why the sailors with Columbus thought that they were going to sail off the edge of the earth, that there was they got into a bad storm. And I can imagine those little ships were coastal sailing ships that Columbus had, the Nina, the Pinta, the Santa Maria, were little Portuguese coastal sailing ships. They were not meant to cross the Atlantic Ocean with a crew. And so at any rate, Columbus said, no, we're going to go on. Sail on. We're going west. And Columbus knew that the earth was round. He had the maps of the old Phoenician sailors. So Columbus was educated. His sailors were not. So they were mutiny. They just about threw Columbus overboard and headed back. Which there was very soon afterwards, there would have been other people that discovered the Americas. And so that may have changed history a little bit. But the idea is that there was mental conditioning when the space shuttle Challenger blew up, and all of the youth were watching the teacher in the space shuttle, and of course dying in front of the entire nation of youth, sending a major message to them that you can't go into outer space, it's dangerous, only NASA can go there, and only designated people. And so at any rate, that is, I always believed, I still believe, that something was amiss with that accident, that so-called accident. And I'm not going to go into that, other than those techniques are used to psychologically, whether it was staged or not staged, that's not the point. The point is that that event dissuaded youth from wanting to go into outer space. And, every student from kindergarten to college at least was watching that, because a lot of the kids in college were part of that program before they went to college. That program went on for years to select the teacher to go into space. So the reason I'm talking about this is to give you a perspective, and this is for people in the future looking back at this in 10, 50, 100, 300 years, to understand how things were at this time in history. The state of society, the state of science in society, and how distorted it is from any type of reality. And so one of the questions is, how could there be so many people that have been fooled? And the answer comes with the situation with education today, where people repeat what they're told, and we're still repeating things that were brought about over 100 years ago, long before the space program, long before we had real space data, long before there was any real analysis of what was going on. And all of these principles were in place way back then, and they couldn't change. Things were not allowed any variance. There was no ability to change anything. And once these topics get so big, like, say, microwave background radiation or dark matter, dark energy, once these things gain a life of their own, it's impossible to stop them. And science moves on without any ability to self-correct. And that's one of the things even Carl Sagan in his Cosmos series talked about, self-correction and science being this molded evolutionary piece of information that potentially could change with time. But really, nothing could be farther from the truth. And he was the epitome of the person establishing the so-called truth that had to be carried on for decades and centuries, and not allowing any change. And then you have international organizations like, say, the UN, which is promoting climate change, and everything has to adhere to this. That is taking the dominant role in science, and it's really nonsensical science. It's not something that there's no real concept of how this works. It's just a statement. And people pick it up, and it becomes a bandwagon and a political football for the power and the maintenance of established science and government, etc., and for a control mechanism. So at any rate, this show has been about the current state of science and scientific ideas and the presentation of science to the public. This is James McCanney, and once again, look at my webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, jmccsci.com are the webpages. Once again, this is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.